Ciao ragazzi, and welcome back to another episode of the Gentleman Ultra podcast. It's your substitute host here again, Luca Hodges Ramon. Once again, standing in for Il Padrone, Richard Hall, who I believe is still drowning his sorrows with bottles of Chianti Classico after England's defeat on Sunday. Only joking, Richard. We all know in your heart you're supporting the Azzurri. Anyway, yeah, we've got a cracking episode for you today, guys, and one I'm very excited about, as you can probably tell. We'll not only be reliving Sunday's glorious triumph for the Italian national side, but also comparing Mancini's Campioni d'Europa to Lippi's Campioni del Mondo of 2006 and that famous night in Berlin. Joining me today, a man as stalwart as Giorgio Chiellini with appreciation for Materazzi's School of Dark Arts, is TGU pod regular Emmett Gates. How are you doing, Emmett?
Yeah, doing good, Luca, doing good. That's a nice intro there. I don't think I can add any more to that.
I thought we'd go big today, given the events of Sunday and the fact that at least the TGU guys are in very good spirits still after the weekend's victory for the Azzurri. I think that's the best place to start, isn't it? Really, no other place to start than to review the game against England. As I said, use that as a lead-in to the triumph in 2006 as well, and compare the two sides. But first of all, Emmett, where did you watch the game? Who were you supporting? I think I know the answer to this. And how did you see it panning out?
Well, I watched the game at home, just by myself. Obviously, just because of the way things are, you know, lockdown restrictions and what have you, here in Northern Ireland. Yeah, so I watched the game at home. As I mentioned on the last episode of the TGU pod, I kind of have this weird relationship. I treat Italy almost like a club side, and I've always backed Italy, supported Italy, even when they were playing Ireland. I always supported Italy. It kind of dates back to the 1994 World Cup and crying for 2 hours when Robbie Baggio put that penalty over the bar. And ever since then, I've just always been Italy. I can't explain it. You know, even playing England or playing Ireland or whatever, it's just, I've always supported Italy. So yeah, Italy have always been my team. It's weird because I've no relations to Italy, no connections with the country other than love for it. So, but yeah, I was supporting Italy and I was watching it just by myself and a couple of peroni, and it was nerve wracking. Like, I'm not even Italian, so I'd imagine what it was like for you.
yeah, absolutely. I watched the game with my old man, and then he came up here to London. We were trying to get tickets, actually. We'd been to the semi-finals in the last 16 against Austria. But in the end, we ended up watching it, at mine with a few of my friends who are obviously England fans. So it was a good atmosphere. We had the Italian corner and the English corner. And it was nerve-wracking, especially the first, obviously, the way Italy started the game. You're just thinking the worst possible start, given you knew it was going to be a cauldron, the atmosphere. You knew that England were going to come out of the blocks quickly, try and take advantage of that home atmosphere and get the crowd behind them. And that was, I think, the only point in the game where I was really worried and I thought it could get away from Italy in this first 15, 20 minutes. Excuse me, that's the phone going in the background. So yeah, I think that was the only time in the game where I felt Italy could potentially lose control of the game in that first 15, 20. I think they did very well to wrestle back control and almost subdue that very fast start that England made with a brilliant goal, obviously, from Luke Shaw. And then, from that moment on, I don't know how you saw it, Emmett. Although it was nerve-wracking, I always felt Italy had a measure of control. Even in the first half, where they weren't really creating anything. I mean, the stats speak for themselves, but England didn't have a shot on target apart from Luke Shaw's goal, so from the second minute onwards. How did you see the tactical battle planning out, and who did you feel made the difference in the end in terms of turning the tide in Italy's favour?
Yeah, like you said, I was worried for Italy in the first 10 minutes. England get that early goal, and Kieran Trippier seemed to have an ocean of space on the right-hand side. I don't know if there was a breakdown in communication between Emerson and Lorenzo Insigne, but Trippier, in those opening 10-15 minutes, he's just seen them all the time in the world. He had half of that side of the pitch at Wembley almost himself. And I honestly was worried. I was thinking England could, if they get another goal here, Italy could be finished already in the opening stages of the game. But I think after, I would say maybe the 25-30 minute mark, Italy slowly then got the grips with the game and started to work their way in. Yes, they weren't really testing Jordan Pickford in the England goal, but they had a measure of control. England weren't really posing any of a danger either, and Italy had the ball. So I was kind of then, it was, I felt it was just a matter of time before Italy eventually broke England down. And it was fascinating to see that Southgate's tactics, he almost resembled the classic Italian sides of yesteryear, getting an early goal and then sitting on the lead and trying to protect what they had, which is what we've seen Italy do for so many years, so many decades. And it was interesting to see an England side take that approach. And
yeah,
I think
it almost resembles what we, the fact that they got punished for doing so really, I guess, resembles what we discussed on our last pod with Euro 2004 and some of the Italy performances there, which ultimately obviously led to, I mean, I don't think England missed chances in the same way that Italy did in that tournament when they were 1-0 up, but certainly being content with the 1-0, sitting back in a very solid kind of banks of four and five, really, trying to soak up pressure and then hoping that on the transition, and I think that's what Southgate was hoping for, that on the transition, a Sterling, a Mason Mount, a Kane, the two wing-backs could capitalise on England, on Italy overcommitting potentially.
Yeah, because I mean, Emerson pushed up pretty high, but Di Lorenzo kind of tucked in beside Giorgio Chiellini and Bonucci. And I think, obviously Southgate's plan was, you know, we'll try and hit Italy on the counter if they push too many men forward. But I think the way England retreated played into Italy's strengths, because Jorginho, Verratti got on the ball, tried to make things happen, but it was very controlled. It was the way Mancini wants this Italy side to play. So I think Southgate's decision to make England retreat didn't... Italy really weren't tested after the opening 15-20 minutes, and it almost became just a case of, will Italy score or when Italy will score? And I think it got to half time. I got to half time and I was kind of thinking, oh, we're 45 minutes away from the end of the world here. England's about to win and we're all going to have to go into hibernation here.
Very much felt like that for me with all the, obviously, be living here in London and the amount of, talk there'd been before the game between myself and my friends about how the game would pan out. I just thought, I'm going to have to leave the country. I'm going to have to go back to Italy. I'm going to have to leave the country because this isn't going to be bearable. That was what I was most worried about. But I think you're right. And I think what I wanted to ask you about is, at half time, Mancini clearly sees that, yes, Italy have started to wrestle back control, but it's still, something isn't quite working in the way it had done in previous games. They weren't really penetrating. They weren't really getting those combinations on the edge of England's box and the fluidity of movement that they'd had in the previous games between Insigne, Chiesa, Berardi when he came on, or in previous games, Verratti, Barella. And that's where I thought bringing Immobile off, bringing the focal point off, and look, I know Immobile's had plenty of criticism throughout this tournament. I think he does serve an important role in what he does for this Italian side. But I think almost actually in terms of an opposite of what Southgate did, he kept Kane on and that allowed Bonucci and Chiellini to have a focal point, a reference point, which they didn't have in the Spain game, which I felt caused Italy the most problems. In all of the games throughout the tournament, was not having that reference point. And Spain almost did to Italy what Italy had done to most other teams. Bringing Immobile off, you know, Stones and Maguire no longer had that focal point, if you like, to latch on to. Also, it allowed a much more rigorous pressing game, I think, which forced Stones, Maguire, Trippier to go longer, and Walker, obviously, to go even more direct to a Kane who is isolated, and then you go direct to Kane who, against Chiellini and Bonucci, and that's playing into their hands, really. They're going to win that battle all day long if you're playing long balls instead of into feet in the kind of half spaces. So I felt that was a really important move from Mancini to bring Berardi on and allow that fluid front three to interchange and to drop into spaces, which made the English back three more uncomfortable, and then dragged Declan Rice into areas where he wasn't being dragged into in the first half. And I felt that was a really tactically astute change from Mancini.
Yeah, I think that's where the game was won from Italy's perspective, in the fact that Mancini brought on Domenico Berardi and Bryan Cristante. Cristante offered a bit more physicality in midfield to kind of combat Declan Rice and Calvin Phillips. And as you alluded to, with taking Immobile off, it allowed Insigne, Berardi and Chiesa just to find pockets of space in between the lines. And as you said, there was no fixed point now with Immobile. And I actually thought it was Insigne's best spell of the game when he was dropping in a little pockets more centrally, and he wasn't hugging the left-hand touchline, and they were kind of interchanging positions. And England really struggled with that. And as you said, Italy did to England what Spain did to Italy in the semi-final, because Italy really struggled with Dani Olmo playing as a false nine. And I definitely think that it gives food for thought for Mancini ahead of the 2022 World Cup about maybe going with the false nine in most games, or it's definitely an option off the bench. Because as we've talked about before, me and you have talked about, Immobile is good when he's got space behind him to run into. But as it happened against Belgium and has happened against England, if defenders are in a low block and he has no space to run into, Immobile is next to useless. Because he doesn't
have... With his back to goal, he's just not as effective.
Yeah, he doesn't have the physicality of a Christian Vieri or even Andrea Belotti. Belotti is more suited to that kind of game.
For sure.
Than Immobile. Sure. So, definitely the false nine, Insigne, Chiesa, Berardi, tactical change that Mancini made is definitely something that he should keep in mind going forward, because Italy caused England no ends of problems in that maybe the opening half an hour of the second half, and that's how Italy really got back into the game.
Yeah, and I think, look, the tactical battle was intriguing, and I also, another element of the game that I wanted to cover with you, and especially because it leads quite nicely into what we're going to speak about in terms of the comparisons between this team in 2006 and that final against France in 2006. And look, there's a lot of differences between this team and that one. But one thing an Italian side will always have is that resilience, that defensive fortitude, but also the dark arts when necessary and required. obviously in this country, and we know it's rather disingenuous sometimes in terms of how the English view the questionable side of other national teams' tactics or behaviour, because you know you see the videos that come out on Twitter afterwards of Italian fans posting Calvin Phillips rolling around on the floor and then somebody getting up and Harry Maguire holding his face when Berardi didn't get anywhere near his face in terms of with the high foot. But I know a lot of England fans who felt, you know, Chiellini's pullback. Yeah, and I know a lot of England fans obviously pointed towards Jorginho's tackle on Grealish.
Yeah.
Chiellini obviously pulling back Saka mercilessly.
I have seen some great, I wouldn't say memes, but pictures. It was like Saka falling out of a window and Chiellini pulling him back.
Grabbing him back, yeah, stopping him from being hit by a train.
Brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. Saka being depicted as a pineapple with the pizza getting away and Chiellini pulling back the pie. I mean, some brilliant memes, but look, I understand that is, not the beautiful side of the game. And I think what this Italian team has done masterfully throughout the tournament is mix the dark arts with playing some beautiful, aesthetically pleasing football. But what I think runs through all Italian sides, and obviously we saw it in 2006 with Materazzi and Zidane, with Fabio Grosso and how he won the penalty against Australia, and with that defensive doggedness that we saw again throughout the tournament in 2006 and Euro 2020, was that there is a mentality within these great Italian sides of we will do what it takes to win a game, and we don't. Chiellini especially does not care what anyone thinks about how he achieves that. So the Saka foul was an embodiment of that. Again, your thoughts on, I guess, that trend that runs through Italian sides, how and the reaction towards it, and I guess, yeah, like I said, leads us nicely through to the World Cup 2006 triumph.
I mean, all great sides have that ruthless streak running through them. I mean, you name me a great team over the last 25 years, 30 years that do not have some element of dark arts in them. I mean, all the great German sides down the years, you know, have all had that. You know, we all remember Schumacher, you know, kneeing Battiston in the face, breaking teeth, yeah. And he never got a red card in the 1982 World Cup. You know, and then you could drown through all the great Italian sides over the years, even the ones that didn't perhaps win trophies. They reached finals, semi-finals. They got close and they all implemented the dark arts. And, you know, the English fans have this mentality, you know, fair play and all this rubbish. But were we the same fans in the semi-final when Raheem Sterling fell over? Let's not, you know... Let's call a spade here. He fell over. There was minimal contact and a penalty was given. And it's something that Chiellini and Bonucci touched on when they were asked. They referred to the Denmark game. And where was the outcry from the English support over that situation? I mean, what we're talking about the dark arts, and you kind of think, well, once Chiellini and Bonucci move on, will the next generation of Italian defenders, really Alessandro Bastoni and the defenders that come up behind Chiellini and Bonucci, will they have that same mentality of thou shall not pass, no matter at any cost, you will not get past me? And it's Chiellini has, I wrote a piece last week about Chiellini has kind of cried about the general state of Italian defending. And that defenders don't want to be like him anymore. They'd rather be like...
It's not glamorous anymore.
Yeah, yeah, they would rather be like Bonucci, who can spread 50-yard diagonal passes.
I would say Bastoni is certainly more of a Bonucci type.
Yeah, than a Chiellini. And Chiellini is almost like a damn breed of defender now. You think of the great Italian defenders of old, like, you know, Claudio Gentile and Pietro Vercovud and player, you know, Beppe Bergami and Fabio Cannavaro. You know, they would not let you pass. Materazzi, yeah. The Matrix, you know. Yeah. The Matrix would, you know, kill you, kill your mother, kill your sister before he would let the ball pass.
Absolutely. I think there was, to be fair as well, watching it on, you know, the English coverage of it as I was, there is still a reluctant admiration, though, as well, of a player like Chiellini, where you've got someone like Rio Ferdinand speaking afterwards who... you can tell, appreciates that just sheer determination to not let anyone past. And I think I saw a stat that Bonucci and Chiellini didn't get dribbled past in the whole tournament in terms of a one-on-one duel.
Yeah.
Which is incredible given their age.
Yeah, considering what Bonucci's 34 and Chiellini's 36, and Chiellini had hardly played for Juve last season.
I was worried about... By the way, I couldn't be happier for Chiellini. He deserves a big European trophy on his CV for the career he's had. But I actually, before the tournament, I don't mind admitting that I was in favour of either starting Bastoni for me, or I know Acerbi was the other option, potentially over Chiellini, just because of how little he'd played. And then when he had played, for me, he'd looked suspect in that Juve. side, he'd been exposed, but obviously in this Italian side, it was a whole different dynamic.
Yeah. Which worked perfectly. Funny, I was the opposite. I was worried for Bonucci because Bonucci has been a train wreck the last.
Yeah.
You know, he went to Milan and he was a disaster at Milan because he didn't have Chiellini to hold his hand. And he came back to Juve then, and for the last 3 years, you know, he's been dining out on the credit that he earned in the middle of last decade. So I was actually, before the tournament started, I actually probably would have had Chiellini and Bastoni in the centre. But Bonucci showed me wrong because he was fantastic the whole tournament. He did not put a foot wrong in all 7 games. Both of them were fantastic, but Bonucci especially kind of showed that, yeah, there's still plenty of quality left in there to go along with the 50-yard diagonal passes in defeat, you know, on either side. But, I mean, it just goes to show you, Chiellini and Bonucci for those 7 games were immaculate. And, you know, Chiellini proved you wrong, Bonucci proved me wrong.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and I think to round it off, I think, again, what this Italian side showed, and again, this leads us into 2006, is what the most striking aspect was, the togetherness, the forza del gruppo.
Yeah.
As we say, that the strength of the group. You know, I was reading things in the press about, in the Italian press, about how the players actually loved being with each other and were, even on their days off, you know, when they got to see their family, were kind of sad that they weren't able to just carry on spending time or uninterrupted within that group and within that bubble. And I think, you know, you saw the scenes with Spinazzola, how they let him go up first to get his winner's medal, and obviously what an amazing tournament he had.
Yeah.
The scenes of Donnarumma, the scenes of Chiellini hugging Locatelli throughout the penalty shootout after he missed the first penalty against Spain. Even the players who hardly played, the camaraderie, I think that's one thing that always defines a successful Italian team, is that group. Nothing is going to drive a wedge in between those players, and adversity, they completely thrive off. I mean, again, first time they went behind in the tournament was in the final against England in front of 65,000 away from home in a cauldron where things could have fallen apart, and that Forza del Gruppo pulled them through that first 20 minutes for sure. And I think that was the most defining element. You can talk about Mancini, how brilliant he was tactically. You can talk about the individual performances, Chiellini, Bonucci, Donnarumma, Jorginho, Verratti when he came in, Locatelli earlier in the tournament, Insigne, Chiesa. You can name all these names, but actually what was the defining element? I think it was the team spirit, the group. As it was when the 2006 team rallied together off the back of the Calciopoli scandal. And I think they're the two big defining elements of both teams.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you look at this Italy squad, you kind of think there was no real one standout player. You know, Donnarumma, exceptional. Chiellini, Bonucci, exceptional. Jorginho, exceptional. Federico Chiesa was exceptional as the tournament grew. But you wouldn't necessarily say, you know, there's no Baggio USA 94 or Christian Vieri, France 98, one player that was head and shoulders above everyone else. And it was nice in that the strength of the group, it was different in comparison to, say, 2006, where they created a siege mentality because of all the stuff with Calciopoli that was going on back home. And they were in Germany and they could kind of shut it all down. And it was us against the world. Whereas with this, it was different. It was all, they just enjoyed, you know, there wasn't that, it wasn't that, you know, everyone's against us this time around. It was just all enjoyed to be together. And, you know, you saw the videos of Insigne playing pranks on Berardi and, you know, on Instagram. And it just seemed like a real jovial, lovely group of lads.
Yeah,
just like almost like lads on holiday. And they just happened to play a bit of football on the side.
Yeah. Singing Notti Magiche on the coach afterwards,
and the tributes to Spina on the airplanes, you know, the Bernardeschi ringing the hospital for Spina and getting all the players to sing Spina, you know, down the phone, and it was lovely to see. Just, they were just a real cohesive group, but there was no, it wasn't a siege-like mentality. It was just, we're just all friends here that are going to play a bit of football and win a trophy, hopefully. But yeah, again, no, that comes down from Mancini. And obviously, Mancini didn't get to play a single minute at Italia 90. And he remembered that crushing disappointment. And made, like, Sirigu got, like, what, 2 minutes or three minutes?
Yeah, against Wales.
Yeah, but yeah, obviously, he was thinking about the group dynamic.
Oh, no, was it against Switzerland? Yeah, yeah, I can't remember who it was.
I think it was Wales in the last game, I think.
It was Wales, yeah.
And obviously, Mancini was just thinking of the group dynamic, keeping it strong, keeping it positive, which was kind of the opposite of what Italy in 2006 was. You know, there was a swirl of negativity. Because obviously, if you remember, there was calls in, even for Italy to pull out of that World Cup because of Calciopoli, because they kicked off like 2 or 3 weeks before the tournament started. So obviously Lippi fostered this everyone's out to get us mentality, but this time around it was completely different, and it was nice to see it. Obviously it was lighthearted. It wasn't, obviously it's a serious occasion, it's a serious tournament, you want to win it, but as you say, when they had the opportunity to spend time with their wives and girlfriends, they kind of, the group just wanted to be with the group, and that's nice to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we do speak more about that 2006 side, I think you just mentioned a player there who's a really good example. That was Bernardeschi. His time at Juventus has been very, very mixed, to say the least.
Yeah.
And disappointing, really. But he just looks a completely different, not only player, but person with that, in that Italian national side. And again, although he didn't play, I would say, significantly in terms of the amount of minutes, you think of the key, he scored both of his penalties in both the shootouts.
And the one against Spain, by the way. Oh, what
unbelievable
a pen.
Penalty. His contribution was as big as any, and you saw what it meant to him at the end when he did his interview where he was breaking down into tears.
Yeah.
Someone like Bernardeschi just captured perfectly what this Italian national side is all about, and I'm just looking forward to Qatar now, because I think, unlike other Italian sides, I think under Mancini and the feeling, as you said, and you bring back Pellegrini, you bring back Sensi, you bring back Zaniolo, or you bring Zaniolo into this group, and again, I think that they've still got more to offer, so it's really exciting. But yeah, moving on to that World Cup 2006 team and the obviously the victory against France in the final in Berlin. This was a team with, I would say, more star names. If you look at the
completely
the starting lineup in the final alone, you had Buffon, obviously the best keeper in the world, Cannavaro, the best centre back in the world, Zambrotta, probably Grosso was the least well known name within that team, and obviously went on to become the hero of the tournament. Midfield, you had Pirlo, Gattuso, Totti, Luca Toni, okay, not a star name, but still very well established by this time. Obviously, players off the bench like De Rossi, Del Piero, Nesta, who had got injured earlier in the tournament. You know, another one of his kind of moments of bad luck in his career.
He was so unlucky with Italy at international tournaments.
He would have won so much more. I think Italy would have won more if he'd not got injured.
Yeah.
Even Pippo Inzaghi, who obviously made his contribution in the group stage, scoring against Czech Republic. You know, this is a team with established names, albeit, as you summarised well just before, coming into the tournament with a sense of siege mentality. Everyone's against us because of the Calciopoli scandal. We have to really here create the strength of the group from this sense of distraction. Almost, let's forget about what's going on in Italy, the criticism that we're receiving from all parts of the footballing world because of Calciopoli, and prove everyone wrong. And in that final against France, in different moments throughout the tournament, there were moments where Italy were potentially on the brink of going out. Obviously against Australia in the last 16, when they're down to 10 men because Materazzi gets sent off.
There's a shocker. Thinking,
yeah, exactly. And you're thinking, this is going to be another South Korea. They're going to get knocked out in the last 16. Totti comes on, scores the penalty in the last minute after Fabio Grosso wins the penalty. Again, slightly dubious, some have pointed towards the fact that he went down very easily, but even the fact that he took the risk of being up there in that moment and made that kind of slithering run into the box. Then you've got the semi-finals against Germany, where you're 2 minutes away from going into a penalty shootout in Germany, with Germany's penalty record again which way that would have gone. I think, again, potentially Germany make it through on a penalty shootout.
Yeah.
Grosso again steps up. And then Del Piero contributes with that goal, fantastic counter-attacking goal. And then you get to the final and you've got Zidane's France, where everyone's billing it as this is Zidane's final triumph, isn't it, really? This is his, it's his building up for Zidane to go out with another World Cup winner's medal. He scores that audacious Cucchiaio Panenka penalty. And then Italy show the resilience once again. So what are your memories from that game specifically, Emmett, and that team under Marcello Lippi, the differences? We've spoken about some of the similarities. What were the differences with Mancini's side? And what helped them triumph, particularly in that final, where, again, the odds at some points during the game were against them?
Yeah, my memories of the final, I'm trying to think, I was 19 at that point. I remember it wasn't the greatest game, you know, spectacle-wise. It was very tactical, very cagey. I mean, bear in mind, I haven't watched the full game since it happened. You know, I've seen highlights, obviously, Materazzi's goal from Pirlo's free kick, or from Pirlo's corner, and obviously Zidane's Cucchiao. And there's a brilliant save that Gigi makes from Zidane header.
Zidane header, yeah.
Yeah, Zidane
just
header.
Before he gets sent off, which is some people think that kind of built up and that was still playing on his mind.
Yeah.
When obviously he made that rash decision Materazzi into the next light year.
First he headbutted the ball and then he headbutts Materazzi.
Exactly, he had practice on the ball first.
But I remember the fight just being, obviously Italy won and I was happy to see Italy win, but I just remember being disappointed that it wasn't the greatest of finals. But obviously that's looking at it through, you know, a late teenager's eyes and not really appreciating the more finer details that go into a game, you know, the tactical changes and the little nuances that you kind of appreciate as you get older. But I remember actually France looking a bit like the England game, France starting well and thinking Italy, you know, could lose this. You had obviously France and Frank Ribery, Thierry Henry, both in their prime. Zizou was 34 and this was supposed to be his swan song, his last game. Obviously, he wants to go out winning another World Cup. But then once Italy equalised, I think Materazzi scores near the end of the first half. And then the game
Materazzi
just...
scores, yeah, from the corner, as you said.
Yeah. And then the game just kind of, I don't know, it almost floated into extra time. You know, there wasn't... You obviously had the Zidane header, and I think Italy maybe...
Luca Toni gets a disallowed goal, but rightly so.
Yeah.
For offside. There's a couple of chances where Buffon makes not amazing save. Well, the save against Zidane's header, fantastic save, but a couple of others where he makes pretty routine saves. But as you said, the game was ebbing and flowing, but never really... I think the actual game of the tournament for Italy was the Germany one.
Oh, yeah.
That was a 0-0 one to 119 minutes. Fantastic end-to-end game. This was a lot cagier, as you said.
Yeah, and it's kind of what we talked about on the Euro 2004 pod. You get nil-nils like Italy-Denmark that are dire, but the nil-nil between Germany and Italy until the 119th minute was spectacular.
Cannavaro! Il contropiede con Totti, dentro il pallone per Girardino, Girardino la porta anche vicino alla bandierina, cerca 2 contro 1, Girardino, dentro Del Piero, Del Piero!
It was end to end, and you're kind of thinking, how is it still 0-0? And then obviously you get the Grasso goal and the Del Piero goal. But the final was, I think, looking back, it was obviously very tense, and then it gets into penalties. And the thing which we briefly talked about, this Italy squad, what excites me most about the current squad is that the 2006 squad kind of felt like this was the end of the road for many of that team. This was the last hurrah. Obviously, Nesta retires, Totti retires, you know, following the tournament. Del Piero at that point, 31. Zambrada, who was probably arguably the best left back in the world at that point, was 29. His peak was here and now. A lot of that team, this was the culmination of many years. They obviously played in the under-21s together. They won the under-21 championship in 96 and 94. And this was kind of the end. You know, that if they hadn't have won it now, they were never going to, by the time they got to Euro 2008, say, or the 2010 World Cup, they were past their peak. Whereas with this Italy side, you
that
kind
was
of...
part of the problem of the 2010 World Cup, wasn't it? It was Lippi trying to recapture.
Yeah, he relies on the old guard too much, and you're bringing along a, you know, 45-year-old Fabio Cannavaro, who had been disastrous at Real Madrid and Juventus going into that World Cup. Mm. Whereas with this side, with Mancini, this you feel like this is the beginning of something. It's not the end, like as it was in 2006.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point in terms of comparing the two sides. And I think this the Mancini side, as you say, is just certainly a lot more fluid in the way they can play.
Yeah.
I think less reliant on certain individuals having performing outstandingly, because Cannavaro was outstanding throughout the tournament.
And even Materazzi. Materazzi, again, like Bonucci and Chiellini, had the tournament of his life. Like, he comes in for Nesta in the second game, and the one tournament wonder. Yeah. He wasn't any good before the 2006 World Cup, and he was no good after it. He just had that month of his life, like a bit like Toto Scarlatti, just had that one month where everything in his life clicked.
My favourite footballing moment, I think, is still that gol di Grosso.
Yeah.
Against Germany. I mean, the commentary from Caressa, the execution in the 119th minute, the no-look pass from Pirlo, the tension, the fact that Italy knew. It's brividi just thinking about it, spine tingling, but, you know, the fact that an Italian side actually recognised, you know what, if we go to penalties against Germany,
we'll probably lose.
With our penalty record, we'd probably lose, so let's just go. That's so unlike an Italian mentality to go, you know what, let's just go for it here in this last 10 minutes.
Because Lippi threw on Del Piero and Gilardino.
Yeah.
Like, in the damn minutes of extra time, because he wanted to try and win the game before it got to penalties.
And they set up that second goal, that brilliant Cannavaro comes steaming out with the ball and makes a couple of brilliant interventions. But, I mean, I think actually, funnily enough, again, because we keep comparing and contrasting the 2020 final to 2006, conversely for Southgate and England, I think they should have approached that second half of extra time as Italy did with Germany.
Yeah.
Is that we either win this in extra time, or knowing our penalty record and knowing Donnarumma's penalty record, because he was the difference maker, I think, just psychologically as well for Italy.
Yeah.
We have to put Rashford on earlier. We have to put Sancho on earlier. We have to put Grealish, because they had the depth. And I was worried in that extra time for Italy, thinking if they bring those kind of players on with the energy, with the speed, with the dynamism that they have, they could cause Italy problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was relieved not to see Sancho and Rashford come on till 2 minutes to go, or 1 minute. So I think conversely, that is a lesson that I'm sure the English side will learn from, but also for Italy, that made the difference in 2006 was saying we need to win this game in extra time. And that, still remains one of my favourite footballing memories. And actually, I couldn't believe it, but one of the football teams that a Sunday league side that we play against here is called Gol di Grosso. just a bunch of guys who not even Italian, who just have fond memories of that World Cup and remember that moment as a kind of legendary moment in the World Cup. So, it's a moment that doesn't just stick out for Italians. I think anyone who lived that World Cup remembers that moment. And then obviously it was fitting that Grosso is the one who scores the deciding penalty against France in the final. And one thing that struck me about that particular game was just the penalty shootout. The Italian penalties are perfect.
Oh, fantastic.
Five. Each penalty is unbelievable. It was Materazzi, Del Piero, De Rossi, Grosso, and
Pirlo.
Who scored? Oh, Pirlo. Yeah, of course, Pirlo, who scored the five. flawless penalties. And I think in that moment, a crowning of, as you said, a generation who deserved to win something with Italy. But as you say, I completely agree. I think this is maybe a good place to kind of reflect and is what next? I mean, what next for this, for Mancini's Italy side? Because we saw what happened to Lippi's Italy side. They, you know, Euro 2008 wasn't the worst campaign, and they only lost on penalties to the best side in Europe in the quarterfinals. And funnily enough, I actually think had they managed to beat Spain there,
they probably would have won.
Psychologically, beating the best team in the tournament may have taken them all the way.
Yeah.
But 2010 disaster, going out in the worst group stage in history of the World Cup, New Zealand, Slovakia and Paraguay, I think it was.
Oh my God. One of the worst like Italian sides. And that, again, as we said, that was Lippi, you know, counting on the old guard, you know, and like he left Balotelli at home, Cassano at home, and you're just thinking, surely a man of Lippi's calibre, yes, you're grateful to the players who took you to the pinnacle in 2006, but surely you have to recognise that they're not the same players 4 years on. You know, it's kind of like I said earlier, a lot of them were pushing, you know, 30 at that point, and Totti and Nesta had retired. You know, you can't rely, it's not 2006 anymore, it's 2010.
Yeah.
And, well, let me ask you this, do you think, because this is something that I've contemplated a lot, do you think that that 2006 win actually hindered Italian football in the longer term?
Yeah, it's a brilliant question. I think the logic behind that, there is some truth to it, because it almost covered and masked or papered over the cracks of essentially what was an impending decline, and what we've seen since the Italian football since 2006, 2007. Yes, Inter, that Inter side who won the Champions League in 2010, but it's not been the same since. And I think the World Cup triumph papered over those cracks and allowed a false sense of progress, really.
Yeah, like
a full sense of Italian. Yeah.
Yeah, it was more, you know, that win was, you know, the Italian way still works. You look at us, we're, you know, Campioni del Mundo. You know, we can still mix it with the best. And then you get the Spain era, and then the German, you know, high pressing era done at rapid speed. And I think had Italy bombed in that World Cup, it actually might have been better in the longer term, in addition to what was going on in the country with Calciopoli, as opposed to them winning and everybody thinking, we're okay, we're good. You know, and then Milan win the Champions League like 11 months later, which then adds another layer of, you know.
Of course, yeah, the 2007 Kaká, yeah, the Kaká team. Again, that was the last high point.
Yeah.
Definitely for Milan, but for attack, because the Inter side, don't get me wrong, fantastic, and obviously Richard will be pulling his hair out.
But there's no Italians in that team.
Not exactly, and trying to we're not taking credit away from that Inter side, but that Milan side, and obviously I'm biased, was the last like really dominant Italian side in Europe. There was no one close to that Milan side that year. And the way they disposed of Man United in the semi-final, 3-0 at San Siro, was just a dominant performance that Italian sides have not got close to recapturing since in Europe. And I think, and ironically, the proof to your theory, Emmett, really lies in this, in Mancini's side, because in 2018, Italian football reached its lowest point, its nadir, by not qualifying for a World Cup. And 3 years later, Mancini has pulled it to its highest point since 2006. And it took that level of crisis, that level of inflection, to say that the Italian national side needs to do something differently. It needs new ideas. Ironically, Prandelli very briefly tried to change things in 2012.
Yeah.
And that Italian side played a good brand of football.
Yeah.
And albeit couldn't carry it through to 2014. But Mancini now has imbued this side with a new sense of energy, with a new sense of purpose, with a new identity, with a new way of playing, which combines the traditional Italian defensive fortitude with the modern techniques or modern styles of play that we see in terms of possession football. Not a kind of intense, non-stop high German press, but an intelligent press in certain times in a game. And I think that needs, well, I'm hoping, and I'm sure under Mancini, it will be here to stay for Qatar. And the only, I think, question mark, and this is where I'm going to throw it back to you, Emmett, and we can potentially finish on, the 2006 side struggled because ultimately they couldn't replace Cannavaro, Nesta, Materazzi. How does the Italian side go about replacing Bonucci and Chiellini? Because realistically, I think this is Chiellini's swan song for the Italian national side. I think Bonucci could come back in Qatar and produce that level of performance that he did in this Euros. We've got Bastoni coming through, but that is very hard to replace a partnership like that. What is coming in behind them, and how do Italy go about, as Chiellini was worrying about, producing that grinta in that position to continue that legacy?
Yeah, it's a difficult one because you have Bastoni coming through, but as we spoke about earlier, Bastoni is more of a Bonucci prototype as opposed to Chiellini. And you kind of look around sides in Italy at the moment, and maybe, you know, young Italian defenders, and you kind of think, where is the next Giorgio Chiellini going to come from? That kind of, you know, take no prisoners, thou shall not pass, any means necessary kind of defender. There is no defenders off the top of my head that scream, oh, this is another Chiellini, in that ilk. Like, I'm even thinking at Juventus, Daniele Regani, who for me is not a Juventus.
Meant to be.
Yeah, he was meant to be the next up and coming, but he's more in the mold of Bonucci again than Chiellini. You know, there's not an ounce of ruggedness to Daniele Regani. And I mean, you look maybe further down the league, you know who would be perfect? Christian Romero of Atalanta. Obviously, he's Argentine, so he's never going to play for Italy, but he is a perfect prototype of what a new kind of hybrid Chiellini type of defender, because he's very rugged, he's quick, he's dynamic, and he's not afraid to get stuck in and tackle and do whatever's necessary. But I don't see anyone in Serie A at the moment, anyone that I've watched in the last couple of years, that you kind of think, yeah, you know, they could eventually replace Chiellini. And I definitely agree with you. I think Bonucci, you'll get another tournament out of Bonucci. But I feel for Chiellini, this is probably, I think it's better to end, go out on a high, retire as a European champion than, you know, I know the World Cup's only, what, another 14, 15 months away. But he should go, don't go out like Cannavaro. Go out like Nesta did, like Totti did, retire as a champion. But you just kind of worry about where the next Chiellini's going to come from. You know, is there anyone that I'm missing? There's no one I can think of off the top of my head.
I was just trying to think of that. I mean, again, another name who's not really fulfilled the potential that people were hoping is Romagnoli.
Yeah.
Who again, he's got a ruggedness to him, for sure.
But he was usurped by Tomori at Milan within weeks.
Exactly. Could we try and naturalise Tomori after a few years? I think that's the only question mark that I have over this Italian side. And look, guys, on Twitter, if we're missing names, please respond to this and suggest who could fulfil the void that Chiellini will leave. I think it will be Bastoni and Bonucci. But as you say, that ruggedness... where is that going to come from? Bonucci certainly has that element to his game, but not in the same way as Chiellini. So it will be interesting looking down the list of centre-backs that Italy could bring to that tournament, who will be called up and who can fill that void. But yeah, that's probably a good place to invite the listeners as well to come up with their contributions, because I think it's going to be a real area that Italy need to look at over the next few years.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'll put it to you, I'll put another question to you. Would you bring Ciro Immobile to guitar, given how poor he played in the Euros?
Yeah, I mean, again, that's a good question. I think, how old is Immobile now? 31, 32, 33. I think Immobile still has a role in this team because of his work ethic, because of the fact that he isn't, like, he's a confidence player. And at Lazio, that system is built for him, and he scores goals and he thrives off that confidence. But he also does have a very good relationship with the other members of the side. And I think if you're bringing a group where you want to keep the group cohesive, he probably does go. I think Belotti has shown in this tournament how important he is to Mancini's side, because he just offers a completely different kind of threat and an alternative, and his hold up play is fantastic. Then it's, you know, again, you look at it, there's a lot of good young forwards coming through in Italy who need exposure and playing time. Moise Kean obviously is yet to really hit the heights that he can potentially deliver and demonstrate. I think then you've got players like Esposito. And at Inter, it will be interesting to see what his opportunities are like over the next year or two. Pinamonti, Zaniolo's not a kind of archetypal number nine forward, but certainly can play anywhere across the forward line or just in behind as a fantasista or a number 10. So there's going to be a lot of options for Mancini. So Immobile could be one who misses out. But again, I think if you go back to that team kind of camaraderie and Forza del Gruppo, Immobile is a big part of that.
Yeah, you imagine Immobile could be in Qatar 2022 what Bernadeschi is to the Euro campaign that just passed. You know, good for the team morale, good in the group, but maybe not getting the minutes, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'll here we go, let's finish on this. Qatar 2022, you know, you go Donnarumma in goal, you go Spinazzola if he's recovered.
Yeah, and that's the thing too with Spinazzola, with an injury like that. I mean, you suffered the same type of injury. You know.
Yeah.
Does he come back the same player?
Yeah. Exactly. That's the question mark there. Di Lorenzo's been fantastic in this tournament. And then you go, say, Bonucci, Bastoni. Let's just, for now, put those two in there. The midfield doesn't really change.
Yeah.
And you've got Locatelli, Pellegrini, Sensi coming in behind, so no worries at all there.
Yeah.
Barella, I think, actually, he had a fantastic game against Belgium, but he's got so much more to offer.
Yeah, in the semi-final, in the final, very disappointed in Barella. Yeah. I don't know if he was, you know, knackered from playing under Antonio Conte for a year, but...
Yeah, I think so. So really, and then the front three, Insigne and Chiesa, pick themselves for me, and Berardi is a really good option as well there. So then, who do we go? That's my question to you. Is it Zaniolo to make it a fluid front three if he's fit, and please God let him be fit, because I think what he could do in an Italian shirt in that side could be spectacular.
Yeah, could be unbelievable.
Or do you go with a more recognised number nine or forward man?
Well, it's kind of like what we spoke about when we were talking at the beginning of the pod about the final, about how fluid Italy looked with the false nine when Insigne dropped into the central position, picking up pockets of space. You know, Zaniolo is that, you know, he's in the same mould as Insigne. He's not a centre forward, a traditional centre forward. There could be a lot of fluidity there between those three if they just alternate positions during the course of a game, and it would actually make Italy more unpredictable and better, I feel, in Qatar, as opposed to you just playing with Immobile or Belotti up front or whoever. You know, maybe there's another breakout star, Raspadori, maybe in the next year.
Raspadori, yeah.
So definitely, you just hope that Zaniolo, you know, he suffered two very bad cruciate ligament injuries. You just hope he's the same player as he was 18 months ago, before he suffered the first one. You hope that it hasn't affected him too much. Absolutely. But he could definitely slide in, and Italy could be, could, you know, Mancini could utilise a false nine from the get-go, as opposed to being an option, a plan B, per se, or a plan C. So I definitely think, I'm definitely excited about where this Italy team can go going forward. And it's kind of like what I said earlier, it's not the end of the road like it was in 2006. There's definitely better things to come. And Italy now are producing, slowly but surely starting to produce players that can fit into the way Mancini wants to play football. Obviously, Arrigo Sacchi oversaw the development after the 2010 debacle, and slowly but surely now young players are coming of an age, you know, in the mid to late teenage years, where they play football in a certain style, and that's also implemented at the highest level with Mancini's team. It kind of, well, like what Spain have been doing for decades, it's all the same. The style is the same. So yeah, I'm quietly confident of where Italy's going over the next 5 years, and definitely by the time we get to Qatar, as say, like, definitely really excited. And I think I personally would maybe try and go for like a false nine if there's no breakout striker coming in the next 18 months, and if Moise Keane doesn't turn out as we hoped he would, I would maybe seriously contemplate implementing a false nine. But then again, is it Zaniolo or someone else? It's kind of hard to say.
It's very exciting, and I think it will be really interesting to see the development of some of these players over the next 18 months, as you said. But certainly, as you said, that DNA and the way, especially Italian midfielders are playing, and you look at the options in that midfield, it's very exciting to look forward and think how that will play out at Qatar.
I really hope that Stefano Sensi gets his injury issues out of the way, because he's a marvellous little player. You know, you bring him on for 15-20 minutes, you know, at the end of games, retain the ball, he's
high energy.
Yeah, high energy, low centre of gravity, he can twist and turn. It's broke my heart to see the amount of injuries he's accumulated since he's joined Inter.
Yeah, exactly that. And Pellegrini's another one who I think can do really well in an Italy shirt. And you saw even someone like Pessina, who was brought in, and a different kind of player to those players, in all honesty. More of almost compare him to a Lampard type, really, in terms of the late runs he makes into the box and the goal threat that he had in the tournament, scoring two goals. So really exciting, and a really good place to leave things. Looking forward to what the future holds, but for now we can just enjoy and bask in the glory of a European Championship title, and be the envy of Europe for 18 or so months until the fun starts again in Qatar. But Emmett, thank you very much for reflecting on these triumphs with me, and thanks again, guys, for listening in, and we'll be back again with another episode of the Gentleman Ultra podcast soon. So ciao ragazzi, statemi bene, forza Italia.